As the centenary of ANZAC approaches and we remember the sacrifices of those who fought and died in World War One, there is another group of heroes that will receive scant attention. And they're the families who've had to care for injured servicemen after the war was over. The caring work done in the aftermath of the First World War was often extremely demanding, almost always unpaid, and most of it done by women. Historian Marina Larson says that as we commemorate the centenary of ANZAC and remember famous battles like the one at Gallipoli, of course, we shouldn't forget that for many, the war was a long one and the struggle went on long after the guns had fallen silent. Marina Larson joins us in our Melbourne studios now. Marina, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Fran.
When we do remember the First World War, we often focus, obviously, on the large number of people who died in the conflict. But as always, the number of those injured who came home injured in some way, mentally or physically, was far greater, wasn't it?
That's right. Modern wars disable more than they kill. So in the First World War, over 300,000 Australian soldiers served overseas. Most people learn at school that 60,000 died, but 90,000 returned with pensionable disabilities. And those men had to live with those physical and mental disabilities for the rest of their lives. So proportionally, if we put that in some kind of perspective, out of every 10 Australian soldiers who went to war, 2 were killed, but a further 3 were disabled.
And what sort of injury, what sort of disability are we talking about? Are we talking about limbs lost? Are we talking about shell shock, as they called it then?
Yes, look, the First World War, as you would know, ushered in a new kind of modern military warfare. So basically, machine guns and poison gas, heavy artillery caused an enormous variety of disability. Men suffered lost body parts, internal wounds, lung conditions from poison gas, blindness, deafness, and facial disfigurement. And what we see happen during the First World War is that medical technologies and surgical advances occurred. So rather than soldiers dying like they might have done in 19th century wars, more soldiers were saved by medical advances, but that meant that there are a higher number of soldiers surviving with disabilities.
And what kind of acknowledgement of these disabilities was there in the community? What kind of support? Well, did we have the state infrastructure to support these people?
Well, yes, Australia set up the Department of Repatriation in 1917 and Australia's first pension system was ushered in. But unfortunately, the pensions were not perhaps as high as they could have been. The 100% pension was only 70% of the average wage, and pensions were provided on a sliding scale. So, for example, there was a case of a carpenter from Sydney who lost his thumb, and he was rated as having a 30% pension, but to him that was 100% loss of income. So when soldiers went to war, they were promised that they would get pensions and be eligible for training courses and so forth, but the reality often didn't live up to the support that they were provided with, and that's why families became so important.
Let's talk about that. You start your essay, which is called Family Casualties. It's a terrific essay for Griffith Review, with the story of Mrs. Clara Stevens, who wrote to the Repat Department in 1927 asking for more help with supporting her son Herbert, who returned from the First World War from the Western Front with shell shock. Tell us a little about that letter.
Sure. This is a letter in the archives of the Repatriation Department. It was written in the late 1920s by Mr. and Mrs. Stevens in rural Victoria. Their son had returned from the First World War with shell shock. He was so badly damaged emotionally that he had to remain living with them. For the rest of his life, he couldn't marry. He was dependent on them. They tried to get him to do a bit of work at home, a bit of work around the farm. They themselves were aging, and they were very worried about who would look after Herbert once they had died. It's a very sad case, that one.
There's a very poignant phrase in that letter where she writes, where Clara Stevens writes, "It has been a long war to us."
Yes, that's right. And I think this is something that perhaps the repatriation authorities didn't realise when the war was on, that yes, they set up a pension system, and yes, there was a network of repatriation hospitals and ANZAC hospitals, hostels for the disabled. But in the majority of cases, once the limits of medical intervention had ceased, once prosthetic limbs had been fitted and so forth, most men, the majority of men, went back to live with their families. And for their wives, for their mothers, This was a long war, I suppose, that they fought. They sacrificed and had to look after their soldiers in the home.
Mm. As you say, these family members became casualties of the Great War too. Would you like to see more, some kind of official recognition of this, or was there any kind of official recognition of this?
The Department of Repatriation gave soldiers brochures and pamphlets saying that you can recover your independence, you can be made well again, you can become breadwinners again. So that they had a very heroic and manly rhetoric around the recovery of disabled soldiers. But the reality was different, and very much hidden away was this invisible tier of support that propped up the repatriation system. And we haven't heard much about it. On Anzac Day, we commemorate the fallen. We don't tend to commemorate those who died from their injuries after the war. In Melbourne, what's happening later this year, I understand, is that there will be a statue unveiled to wives and mothers who cared for the disabled soldiers of the First World War. And I'm very pleased to see that happening, because they are a group of women, and there are women carers who are related to soldiers from each successive war who have, in the interior of the family home, had to really sacrifice many years of their life picking up the pieces of the war that has disabled their son, their husband, their brother.
I presume the same is true today. I mean, this caring work goes on today. If you've got a son or a husband who's come home from the war damaged, and so many of them do, the burden will always fall on those closest to them.
That's right. Families are still a key site of repatriation, and there are still similar issues that are playing out. And I think this is because there are real limits to what medicine and psychology can do. Once the doctors and the psychologists have done their best and rehabilitated men and women as best they can, the family is the place that soldiers always return to, and families can be sites of care. They can be very, very therapeutic and a site of comfort. And from a government's perspective, families are free. All this work by women is done unpaid. But if the government would like to continue to rely on families to be a therapeutic site of care for returned soldiers, they need to give more resources to supporting families to do this work, and recognising the primary role they play and the cost that they bear as a consequence.
Absolutely. Thank God for the families. Marina Larsen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Fran.
Marina Larsen is an historian and author of the book Shattered Anzacs, Living with the Scars of War. And she's just written this essay for Griffith Review. It's called Family Casualties. And it's really a terrific read.